It's Election Day 2020, and the world is watching without knowing when we'll actually know all of the results.
Emotions are running high, anxiety is running high, and as a result, you want the answer. You don't want to sit with that anxious uncertainty, but that may be exactly what we have to do.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for November 3rd, 2020, we may not have all the answers for you yet, but we've got some good stuff for you on this election day, including advice on how to follow those election results. Plus, hurricanes and wildfires on top of the coronavirus pandemic, how disasters upon disasters are affecting voter access and turnout.
Between trying to deal with the insurance and worrying about their home and the other million things that they had to deal with, they wanted to figure out how to vote, but it was not the top thing on their mind.
But first, nearly 100 million people have already submitted their ballots in early voting. That's more than 71% of the total number of votes that were cast in 2016. Across the country, voters are taking to the polls today in their last opportunity to cast a ballot. So we're checking in with public radio reporters around the country in key states to see how the voting process there is playing out. We start in the state of Wisconsin.
My name is Rob Menser. I am the rural communities reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm based in central Wisconsin. So in Wisconsin, as in a lot of places, there was a huge wave of absentee voting. And so we have had something on the order of 1.5 million absentee ballots that were returned ahead of Election Day. And Wisconsin is also a state that does not permit tabulating of ballots before Election Day. So clerks across the state, are sitting on these large caches of absentee ballots that won't be tabulated and sort of counted until after voting closes tonight, which is why we expect that in Wisconsin, the results might take until, well into Wednesday morning for us to know what the election looks like. Wisconsin right now is one of the top hotspots for COVID-19 in the nation. And in some parts of the state, infection rates have been climbing and hospitalization rates and so on. And so this is one reason why so many people had chose to vote early, but it's like not distributed evenly across the state. The urban areas and suburban areas are much more likely to have requested and returned absentee ballots than in rural areas. Still, less than half of expected voter turnout has been absentee in rural areas. So there's an expectation that there will be a lot more people voting in person. And so as a result, there's more risk of exposure to the disease. Wisconsin has same-day voter registration. So as far as barriers to voting, Wisconsin has a voter ID requirement, which was very controversial and fought over in courts, but ultimately upheld since it was passed. And some people see that as a barrier to voting. However, there is same-day voter registration. So people who have an ID and have can sort of prove their residency and so on, have the option to show up at the polls and register and still have cast a vote that's going to count in this election.
Next, we move south to North Carolina.
I'm Rusty Jacobs. I cover politics for North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's not an overstatement to say that the turnout during 17 days of early voting, that's in-person voting, as well as absentee by mail voting, has been unprecedented. North Carolina heading into Election Day saw more than 61% of registered voters turn out with early in-person voting and absentee by mail. North Carolina put itself in a really good position to deal with the flood of absentee ballots this year. North Carolina legislators passed a bill in June, a bipartisan bill, which is rare in these parts, that eased a lot of rules around absentee voting, including giving county boards the authority to start tabulating, processing absentee ballots as much as 5 weeks away from Election Day. That will ease the counting in the home stretch or at the end of Election Day. That being said, that doesn't mean there hasn't been a lot of partisan rancor and strife around, especially the issue of absentee ballot rules. After the legislation was passed in June that did ease some absentee ballot rules, advocacy groups started filing lawsuits against state agencies, including the Elections Board. The Elections Board tried to settle a lot of these lawsuits with a comprehensive agreement. And what they proposed was extending the deadline for counting absentee ballots postmarked by but received after Election Day. The state law had already said that ballots postmarked by Election Day but received up to 3 days afterwards could be counted. They, that is the Elections Board, extended that to 9 days, November 12th, 9 days after Election Day. Republicans in the legislature immediately sought to block that in courts. And as you may know, the U.S. Supreme Court, a majority, a 5-3 majority, decided not to intervene and not to grant the Republicans' request for an emergency stay. So that extended deadline exists.
Pennsylvania could be a huge tipping point this year. Let's head there now.
My name is Katie Meyer. I'm the political reporter for WHYY Public Radio in Philadelphia. We've kind of seen our counties become overloaded and had to learn new systems and new procedures on the fly in a way that they didn't expect to before. And one of the biggest things that's come out of that is it's just going to take us a really long time to count votes. Pennsylvania is allowing some votes to be counted between 8 p.m. on November 3rd, when the count is supposed to be cut off, and 5 p.m. on November 6th. And that was because, you know, the state Supreme Court allowed that extension because of mail delays. The Trump administration has been calling into question, and Republicans in the state and Republicans elsewhere in Pennsylvania have been saying that they don't believe that those votes should be counted because they think it's not legal. So there have been lawsuits moving up and down through the state and into the Supreme Court. The extension has been upheld for now, but we could see more lawsuits afterward. So that's part of this. The other issue is, you know, the Trump administration has also been saying, oh, well, you know, if we don't have the count on election night, then there might be questions about how, you know, if how legitimate the count is. And, you know, the answer here is just that we were never going to have a result in Pennsylvania on election night. You know, it's just, it's too many ballots to count. It's just going to take a long time. You won't see results from Pennsylvania on election night. You're going to see some results, but they won't be complete. All of this logistical stuff has been tough for voters, and I think it makes it even tougher because we are sort of the consensus swing state.
One of the big questions this year is, will the Lone Star State of Texas turn blue?
My name is Joey Palacios. I'm the local government reporter in San Antonio for Texas Public Radio. We're seeing a surge of voting in Texas right now. At the end of early voting on Friday, about 9.7 million people have already voted, and that surpasses the entire 2016 election, including Election Day back then. About 9 million people had voted then, so we are already ahead of Election Day. So it's worth noting that we have had actually 6 extra days of voting because of the pandemic. The governor issued an executive order that extended the early voting time period. And as you can see, we've already surpassed the number of voters that participated in 2016. So there's been some back and forth. One of the biggest challenges that happened was who can vote by mail. So Texas has rules in place that you can really only vote by mail if you're disabled or if you are above 65 years of age, if you're in jail, or if you're going to be outside of the county during early voting and election day. But because of the pandemic, there were people who wanted to vote by mail. So there were court challenges, but ultimately it was decided that vote by mail could only be done by folks that fit that prescription, that fear of contracting COVID-19 didn't count as a disability. So even then, we have seen record usage of mail ballots. Here in Bexar County in San Antonio, where I am right now, we have well more than double the record of previous mail ballots that have been counted in prior elections. And there's still ballots that have to come in by Election Day.
Up here in New York City, something we're not used to, long voting lines.
My name is Bridget Bergen. I'm the City Hall and Politics reporter at WNYC, New York Public Radio. It's the first presidential election in New York with early voting, and voters took advantage of those 9 extra days to cast their ballots. More than 1 million voters turned out for early voting here in New York City. That's about 20% of the eligible registered voters. And altogether across New York State, About 18% of the eligible registered voters turned out for early voting. And if you compare that to the number of voters who participated in the 2016 general election, we've already seen about 40% of the eligible voters cast their ballots so far in 2020. Now, among the issues facing people who cast those early votes was long lines at the polls. The City Board of Elections had to extend early voting hours and add an additional early voting site for the final weekend of early voting. But we also saw that issue affect voters in other parts of the state of New York. In Ulster and Rockland counties, the boards of elections there were sued by lawyers because of the long lines, and they were forced to extend early voting hours in both of those localities. There are concerns about intimidation at the polls. We will have observers from election protection, as we always do, out at poll sites, offering bipartisan assistance to voters who have questions. But New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio also has organized a volunteer corps of more than 500 volunteers who are going to be going out to poll sites. They'll be wearing stickers that say Election Observer Corps, and they will be another set of eyes and ears on the ground. In general, we're really looking to see how much that early voting turnout takes away the pressure on Election Day poll sites.
And finally, we go down to Florida, another state that could tip the election in the Electoral College.
My name is Danny Rivero. I'm a reporter and producer for WLRN Public Radio, the NPR station here in Miami. Honestly, I think the Latino vote here could be a decisive factor. Also, just the number of African Americans and Black Caribbeans. You know, we have a ton of West Indians here. And a lot of them are extremely motivated to vote, especially because Kamala Harris is on the ticket and she's, you know, Jamaican and of Indian descent. So that's really motivated some people to get out there and vote. And there's also a really big Haitian American voting bloc that a big chunk of them went for Trump last time around. And I've talked to a couple people that voted for Trump last time in that community, and they said, we're not doing it again. You know, so there's a lot of open questions about whether Haitians and West Indians and African Americans are really going to show up to vote for a Democrat. It's a very big population. And if they do that in numbers, then that could also be a decisive factor. The election system here in Florida this cycle was actually well established. We can start counting early ballots 22 days out. We have a really robust early voting system. There's drop boxes, multiple in every county. And the lines, you know, the first couple days of early voting, there were some pretty long lines, but that's more or less smoothed out over the days. State by state, we're in really good shape. The thing that always screws us over is just the margins. Like, the margins of victory here are so small and so narrow that things often get thrown into a recount situation. But that doesn't mean the system is bad. It just means they're close elections. We had a situation here in South Miami-Dade County just over the weekend where, you know, there was reports that there was a huge backlog of mail at one of the main processing centers. Our prosecutor here actually called on the federal officials to go investigate it. And they did come up with dozens of ballots that were supposed to be delivered to people, but that never made it. And now there's ongoing investigations into other post offices around here to see how many of those ballots just never got delivered. You know, that could end up being a big walkaway narrative from this election. A lot of people change the way that they vote. And when you change the way that you vote and it's brand new, it's more subject to errors.
Big thanks to our friends at Wisconsin Public Radio, WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, WHYY in Philadelphia, Texas Public Radio, WLRN in Miami, and of course, our own local WNYC newsroom here in New York City. . 2020 has been a record year for hurricanes, wildfires, and other climate-related weather disasters, and that's made the voting process more of a challenge for certain voters around the country. This recent string of climate disasters, from wildfires in states like California, Oregon, and Colorado, to Hurricane Zeta along the Gulf Coast, have complicated an already difficult election year, as evacuees and others affected by these disasters navigate how to cast their votes. For more on this, I spoke to Jan Childs, a writer for weather.com, and Adam Reyes, the rural and small communities reporter at KUNC in Colorado. And according to Adam, it's unclear just how much the wildfires have already affected the early voting process, at least in Colorado.
We don't know exactly how many of the people that are evacuated from the fire are voters. And even from among those, it's difficult to tell how many have already cast their ballots, as mail-in voting has been going on for several weeks, as has in-person voting and drop box voting. So it's really difficult to get a handle on that. Overall, Colorado, we're seeing really good return numbers, and the counties that are mostly affected by the fires are seeing record-breaking return numbers as of the state overall.
What have the options been for voters, especially people who have been evacuated from their communities, even up to today, Election Day?
Polling centers have been open since October 19th in many areas, and there are more opening as Election Day approaches. So voters can go to any of those anywhere in their county if they evacuated somewhere else in the same county, or if they go to one in somewhere else in the state, they can use what's called a statewide ballot, which would essentially just take off all the local races and allow them to vote on the national and statewide races and questions. If they have their mail-in ballot and they took it with them when they evacuated, as we've heard several people did do, was one of the first things people packed, I've been told, in some cases, they can take those and put them into any drop box in the state, and that'll go, even if it's a different county from their own, the clerk in that county will deliver all ballots from their drop box that's outside of the county to the home county's election offices. There's also emergency options. They don't really advertise a lot of these options because specific situations require specific solutions, and they don't want voters to get confused or misjudge whether or not they qualify for a certain option. But one of the areas that was hit by the fire the hardest, a small mountain community, has been telling its voters that they can actually use an online ballot, though I was just told as of the morning before Election Day that only 5 voters had taken advantage of that.
It's interesting that you say that there were people who were evacuating and thinking about their ballots and packing those. That shows a serious interest and commitment to voting. Jan, let's bring you in here. Wildfires are not all that we've experienced this year. Hurricanes like Hurricane Zeta, which is the latest that we're experiencing, how have they complicated the early voting process in the Gulf region?
Louisiana in particular has been hit especially hard this year. They've had, 5 storms make landfall in the state. And so a lot of that is kind of similar to some of the things that Adam was saying in terms of the options for voting and things like that. And it's also true that we don't really know yet how that might affected turnout among people who are evacuated or, displaced from their homes. Their early voting ended before Hurricane Zeta, so they had already completed it. But they were really concerned, about how people would vote in areas like Lake Charles. That entire parish was under a mandatory evacuation for 2 hurricanes. There's a couple thousand people still living in hotels outside of the parish and, people dealing with repairs to their homes and things like that. And so there was a lot of question about how that might go. Well, they had twice the number of voters turn out this year for early voting than they did in 2016. You can't say for sure how many more might have turned out if there hadn't been these storms and hurricanes happening, but it didn't appear to have a dramatic impact that we can see right now. But it's like Adam said, we really won't know until it's all said and done. And the ongoing issues they have there now, though, are power outages that are still an issue in the areas that were hit by Zeta, southeast Louisiana right now. So they're having to bring in generators and things like that to make sure that the polling places can be all up and running and everything goes smoothly today.
Is the expectation that they will be able to maintain the polls open at least till the end of Election Day?
That is the expectation. That's what they're saying. As of yesterday, they were bringing in generators to the places that didn't already have them. The power company also there in Louisiana also prioritized getting power back to those polling locations. So many of those already had their power back anyway. In Lake Charles, though, they did have to consolidate most of their polling places into just a couple of larger locations. So people there have to go to a different place to vote than they normally would have. And there's always concern about that because anytime you put any inconvenience to voting, it tends to be a barrier for some people.
It's not just hurricanes that we're concerned about here. It's also an ice storm that came through in October in the state of Oklahoma, and that's left thousands of people without power. What's happening there? How has that community tried to gather itself for Election Day?
A lot of those power outages are in and around Oklahoma City. So you've got a large number of people there. They're doing the same thing there that they're doing in Louisiana, bringing in generators that they have set up to have their polling places open. And their early voting didn't appear to have any disruptions in terms of people not being able to vote. You know, it's a little bit of a different situation there because people aren't evacuated.
I want to go back to Colorado for just a second. Adam, I'm still thinking about the folks who have, who you said that you talked to, who packed their ballots as they were evacuating. I mean, that's a time when you think about family photos and things like that. What are some of the emotional challenges, Adam, that voters who are dealing with natural disasters are facing?
The primary emotions are just kind of a lot of stress right now. I spoke to two evacuees about this issue primarily. Both of them have actually, luckily, recently been able to get back into their homes, although one of them is under a pre-evacuation order and may be forced to leave again. But a lot of it was just a lot of stress. And I had one tell me that between trying to deal with the insurance and trying to work from a hotel room, you know, and worrying about their home and the other million things that they had to deal with, that they were wanted to figure out how to vote, but it was not the top thing on their mind, that they had much more important things to deal with and much more stressful things to kind of process.
Jan, is this has this set a precedent this year in particular because of everything that's happening with the coronavirus, or have natural disasters disrupted past elections in the U.S.? I'm trying to think about whether they've had a similar effect, because this year is in many ways unique in the amount of people who have turned out to the polls to do early voting, despite everything that they're experiencing.
We all know this year has been unprecedented in so many ways. And I think there's still a lot of things that like we've already mentioned, that we won't know until, you know, everything's said and done. Bad weather has interrupted elections before. Actually, the best example is probably Hurricane Sandy in 2012, because that was also a presidential election year, and that storm hit a week before Election Day. They had to make a lot of last minute changes there, and it was really a scramble. It was very chaotic. There was lots of controversy. That election has been studied by researchers, still ongoing. And really, after that, a lot of states put emergency plans into place.
Adam, we've been talking about the effect that natural disasters like wildfires and hurricanes and ice storms are having on how people vote. But I'm wondering whether these disasters have also changed the way or who they might vote for.
So there's actually very little recent and reliable polling on the wildfires' impacts on voting patterns for Colorado voters and voters in areas specifically affected by fires more generally. There is some national polling there's a variety of groups, The Economist, Kaiser Family Foundation, New York Times, and Pew, but a lot of it was done just as, if not well before, the two largest fires in Colorado started to see that explosive growth, though California and Oregon had already seen some of their biggest fire growth at that point. The little polling that we do have on this that asks about fire specifically tends to be polling people specifically on its relationship to climate change. We know that the longer and harsher fire seasons are definitely a function of that. It's kind of being used as a stand-in. So in many of the recent polls on election issues, belief in climate change and the value placed on that belief tends to be pretty sharply divided along party and candidate lines, mirroring how the two parties' presidential candidates talk about it on the campaign trail. And in general, polls do say the majority of voters are concerned about climate change to at least some, if not a significant degree. But between coronavirus and the economic downturn, for a lot of these polled voters, it wasn't the top issue going into this election.
Jan, you mentioned that there are different emergency plans that have been put into place. What are some examples of those, thinking about the state of Louisiana, for example, or Georgia?
In Louisiana, what they're doing right now is getting the generators in place. They also have backup batteries on their voting machines, which can last up to 8 hours.
Adam, given that the polls are open for a couple more hours today, what advice would you give people who are heading out to the polls who have dealt with these types of natural disasters?
And a piece of advice I've gotten from local elections officials across the northern half of Colorado is consistently call your county clerk, call your county clerk, call your county clerk. If you are not able to access a ballot and you want to not go vote in person, or for some reason voting in person would be difficult, or you don't want to just use a statewide ballot, call your county clerk. They'll be able to tell you how your state's laws and their local resources will be able to support you in whatever situation you're dealing with. And that applies to any variety of emergency situations, from injury to coronavirus to the fires.
Jan, anything on your end? Any advice for folks as they head out for these final opportunities to cast a ballot in this election?
Pay attention to your local officials, and if you're in one of these areas affected by the power outages, you know, check and make sure that you're going to the right place to vote.
Jan Childs is a writer for weather.com, and Adam Reyes is the rural and small communities reporter at KUNC. Jan, Adam, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Tanzina.
My pleasure.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
How are you going to watch this election unfold? Some of you will listen to the radio, others will watch cable news pundits, and still others will doom scroll through social media. But one thing's for certain is that whatever your media consumption will be today, you may want to line up some snacks and be ready for some uncertainty. Margaret Sullivan is a media columnist at the Washington Post, and she's got some tips for how journalists and the public should proceed on this big night. Margaret, welcome back to the show. It's so great to have you with us today of all days.
Thank you so much for having me on Election Day.
We have arrived. The day is here. And according to your new column, Election Day will be the media's D-Day. What does that mean?
Well, I think it's a really important test. What I mean by that is that this is an extremely important make or break day for the news media to do a good job. It's not about what happens. It's about whether the media can do its job properly, which is to, you know, most of what I'm thinking about is not to magnify untruths, to explain in context, not to parrot things that are wrong, all the things that we have unfortunately fallen prey to quite a bit during the Trump administration.
You also talk about having patience. You're asking journalists to have patience?
Well, I know it's a big ask, but I do think that, I mean, it may not turn out to be necessary. I mean, if there's a landslide of one sort or another, then certainly we're going to know on election night what has happened. But if it's a relatively close race, that could be much more of an issue, because in the early moments, in the early hours, even into, you know, the next day, it may look like one thing and turn out to be something else entirely, because all the ballots haven't been counted, and or at least a lot of them haven't been counted in key states, for example, Pennsylvania.
You're cautioning journalists to also be careful about calling races too quickly. What's at stake if they do not heed that warning?
Well, it lends itself, unfortunately, to a situation in which, and I mean, I don't think we have to be too, you know, careful about who's going to do this or not. President Trump has already laid lots of the groundwork for saying that if he's ahead, then he's going to declare victory. Well, if he does that, and if the media parrots that, or if the news media's various decision desks are saying, well, it does look like it's headed in this direction, or whatever it may be, then if it turns around the other way, it's going to look like fraud, or it's going to look like an illegitimate outcome, which it may well not be. It may just be a matter of the votes aren't fully in. And as you know, Tanzina, this is a really unusual election for so many reasons, but one of them is that we have way more mail-in ballots than we ever have before, and much more turnout than, well, I'm certainly expecting much more turnout than there has been in recent years, in recent presidential cycles.
You mentioned the media's decision desks on election night. What are they and how do they work?
Well, they're, you know, usually at the big media organizations, there's a group of people, veteran journalists, or, you know, some of them are more on the sort of numbers crunching side of things, who analyze the races, look at, you know, key precincts, and eventually make a decision about whether they can say, okay, yes, Wisconsin has gone to X person. An interesting one is the one at Fox News, which, you know, we all think that Fox News is very pro-Trump and that their coverage is very right-leaning, but they have one of the best and most respected decision desks that is quite separate from the news content. So, you know, they have a really, it's a very interesting situation. So, you know, will these decision desks take their time and be really sure? I think they need to be extra sure this year.
You yourself have had to make some pretty dicey early calls in presidential races.
Tell us
about what you learned in that process.
You know, I've been a journalist for a long time, a couple decades, and the one that sticks out in my mind, as it does for many, was the 2000 election when the, you know, George W. Bush versus Al Gore, and it really all came down to Florida. At that time, in 2000, our print edition at the Buffalo News, where I was the top editor, was still extremely important. And we had to make a decision. I had to make a decision about what kind of headline to put on the papers that people were going to get at their doorsteps the next morning. And as it happened, a consortium of news organizations originally called Florida for Bush. And so, you know, many of us went with headlines that said, ours said, for a very early edition, Bush apparent winner. But then within minutes, they reversed that and said Florida was still up for grabs. And so we ended up sending out a few that said Bush apparent winner. And then for the rest of our editions, which went to most everybody, it said something like down to the wire. But a lot of papers did much worse on that and said, you know, went ahead and said that Bush had won. And a few, not as many, but a few even declared Gore the winner. So it's a cautionary tale. You never want to have that Dewey defeats Truman moment like one of the Chicago papers did many years ago.
So back in September, Margaret, you wrote that the media needs to prepare the public for uncertainty. And there is a lot of uncertainty. I think that's part of why we're seeing such record turnout in advance of today. But that uncertainty could still be with us tonight as these ballots come in. And some news outlets could be at risk of really putting forth the idea that delayed results are an indication that the process is broken in some way.
That's right. I think actually I'm a little bit, it's not like me to be particularly complimentary or optimistic about the news media, as you know, but I actually think from having watched a lot of network news, a lot of cable news, read a lot of, you know, different organizations' work, I think that the news media actually has prepared people who are paying attention, for the fact that election night might not be the time when they really know the winner. But there's another factor here, which is that for a lot of people, you know, and a good portion of the public, they're not paying attention in that way. They're going to start paying attention, you know, sometime during the evening, you know, paying close attention and say, okay, I'm going to turn on CNN or whatever it may be, and I, you know, expect to know the answer. And if I don't know the answer, well, something must be very, very wrong. So while I think it's been pretty good, it's not all on the media. Some of it is on citizens and news consumers, whichever you like to call them, to really be discerning and to be well informed. And, you know, we see all different degrees of that.
And to be able to sit with the uncertainty for a little bit, if that's what's being called for, right?
Yeah, that's really hard to do, especially because people have such strong feelings about this election. you know, everybody, no matter who you support, is ready to say that the other side is going to take us into some sort of end of the world scenario. And so emotions are running high, anxiety is running high. And as a result, you want the answer. You don't want to sit with that anxious uncertainty, but that may be exactly what we have to do.
As we are heading into the final moments for Americans to be able to cast their ballot here in this country, Margaret, how are you going to be following all of this? Are you going to be doing a combination of social media following and maybe TV? And of course, the takeaway will be part of that. But how are you going to be doing it? And also, how should folks who aren't journalists be following it? What's the best piece of advice for them?
Well, I think the best thing to do and the thing that I like to do is compare and contrast. You know, don't just say, all right, my only news source, even if it's a wonderful one, is going to be X and that's it. I think it's important to look across the different platforms, the different social media platforms, the different broadcast networks, the different print outlets, radio. You know, that doesn't mean you have to make a science out of it, but maybe to pick two or three that have slightly different points of view and see how they're covering things. So for me, of course, because I write about the news media all the time, I, of course, look at Twitter a lot. I, of course, look at the major print organizations, the major networks. And I also make sure that I see what right-leaning or pro-Trump media is doing too. So I will definitely be spending some time on Fox News and others that will be telling probably quite a different story than what we're seeing elsewhere.
It'll be a long day for many of us. Margaret Sullivan is a media columnist at The Washington Post and frequent guest here on The Takeaway. Margaret, thanks as always.
You are so welcome. Great to be with you and your listeners, Tanzina.
This election marks the first time in U.S. history that the number of eligible Latino voters is expected to be higher than the number of eligible Black voters. And that means that there's been a renewed focus on how Latinos could shape the results in states like Florida and Texas. But to fully understand Latino voters in this election, it's important to take a step back and acknowledge the long history of voter suppression against Latinos in the United States, which date back for more than a century. Over the past month, we've been covering some of the issues that matter most to Latino voters in this election cycle in our series, A Votar. And through it all, we've been hearing from our Latino listeners on this.
Hi, this is Paula. I'm calling from West Palm Beach, Florida. I'm a Latina. I'm voting for all my fellow Latina and Latino people in this country who need a path to citizenship and will never get it under the current administration. I'm voting for all the minorities in this country, and I'm voting for democracy so that it can survive.
My name is Francisco Santa Marina, and I'm calling from Seattle. Both my wife and I are Latinx voters, and we feel very strongly that having a president that reflects our own values and those of our families is critical. Someone who believes in science, someone who believes in decency and respect.
I'm joined now by Michelle Garcia, a journalist and essayist who recently wrote about the history of Latinos and voter suppression for the Texas Observer and Palabra. Thanks for being with me, Michelle.
It's good to be here.
Michelle, your piece for the Texas Observer starts on election night 2018. Why was that the starting point?
That night really stayed with me because I'm at a election night party watching the returns come in Austin, across the street from the University of Texas at Austin. Really interesting group of political junkies and students and organizers. And I'm asking them, why are you here? What is it about elections and voting that means something to you? And everybody had a memory that they invoked, whether it was the elder who said, I remember going to the union meetings with my parents and watching what organizing community can do, to the young African-American woman at the local historically Black college who said, we marched to the polls today, like they did in the 60s, right? This is my legacy. I'm part of that history. And meanwhile, in Dallas, you had David Villalobos, you know, who was watching the returns and whose connection was his childhood memory of block walking, you know, knocking on doors with his mom in Laredo, Texas, you know, campaigning. And I began to wonder, how important was it, or is it, to have a memory, to have a sense that your vote connects to a larger narrative, that you belong to a legacy of democracy and the fight for a vote? How significant is that to either motivating people to vote or also understanding what it means when, as you said, the Latino numbers are so, you know, historic high this year, and you're seeing a historic turnout?
Interestingly, we often hear about voter suppression tactics and poll taxes and literacy tests and threats of violence that have been used against African-American voters in this country. Tell us about how those tactics were also used against Latino voters in the 20th century.
I think part of why we don't hear about this as much is because of geography. So much of the history of this country is told from east to west. But in New York, for example, in the 1930s, you would have a Puerto Rican woman go to the polls. I found an oral history in which she's recounting going to the polls in Brooklyn and confronting a literacy test, and was able only to vote because there was another Puerto Rican in the neighborhood, a woman who was going around helping people prepare for that test so that they could cast that ballot. But you had those same tests going on in Arizona. You had them going on in Texas. Arizona passed laws that required minimum education, property ownership. Texas passed a law in the early 20th century that just made it outright illegal to have interpreters, Spanish language interpreters, at the polls. But it went from poll taxes and literacy tests to violence. You had the state police in Texas used to suppress the vote, where Mexican Americans who could read and write and could pay the poll tax were threatened by being sent to the penitentiary if they tried to cast a ballot. You had all sorts of intimidation for decades going on in Arizona, in Texas, in other states, New Jersey, that were keeping people from the polls. We have to consider that in Arizona, for example, there was a poll watching campaign in the 1960s in which Mexican Americans and blacks were forced to recite portions of the Constitution. This campaign was called Eagle Eye. And if they couldn't comply, they were barred from voting. And one of the people who carried this out was William Rehnquist, who went on, as we know, to become a U.S. Supreme Court Justice and Chief Justice. So this is the level of suppression that was institutional by law enforcement. It was called a spirit of terrorism, was how it was described by some lawyers. In the 1970s, Justice Thurgood Marshall wrote in an opinion that Latinos faced, quote, a pervasive evil that was national in scope, and it was aggravated by acts of physical, economic, and political intimidation. So you really see the range. And what is so interesting and important right now is this history becomes institutionalized. It becomes, creates a chilling factor that then interrupts the tradition of voting that's necessary to have a turnout. And so this is what so many groups have had to overcome. And the basis for this was, as Jovita Gonzalez wrote in the early 20th century, Mexican Americans were considered, quote, unfit to vote. Now consider that in 2017, Evan Smith, who's the founder of the Texas Tribune, told the New Yorker that there was a backlash to the rising Latino political influence in Texas because they were, quote, seen as unworthy. So this history forms the context for understanding current events, tactics, long lines we see and in early voting and we will probably see today on Election Day.
This history is often not talked about, Michelle, and I think part of it is really a lack of understanding of what role Latinos played in their own right in the civil rights movements in this country for their own right to vote. And why is it that we don't know as much about this as we hear about other attempts at voter suppression?
You're absolutely right. And what you just said has an echo through time. In 1967, The Atlantic magazine published a story called The Minority Nobody Knows. And in it, it said, when people on the East Coast, when the media elite, when the political elite think about Latinos at all, they imagine Mexican-American workers stooped in the fields. And in the 1960s, in that same article, a union organizer, scholar, writer, his name was Ernesto Gallarzo. He said, quote, historically, Mexican-Americans have not been seen as a great constitutional and moral issue, as were the Negroes, nor as an ordinary immigrant group to be acculturated or assimilated. They have been looked on simply as an ever-replenishing supply of cheap and docile labor. So when you have a history that is told that does not include that moral imperative, that history of violence that was carried out in the Western expansion, then you have a story of Latinos that is relegated to the perennial new arrival.
Just or, Michelle, I would even argue this particular election cycle, there's been an odd fascination with Latinos, conservative voters, and Latinos who are anti-Black. And I think that this is all a critical part of our cultural reckoning, if you will. But still, a quarter of Latinos, maybe a third, but really about a quarter of them identify as conservatives and will vote that way. And I think that the media's obsession with that narrative is obfuscating some of the history that you're talking about here.
Absolutely. And the irony to that is there's so much sort of curiosity about who are these outliers, right? And so many theories, you know, does it have to do with masculinity? Does it have to do with you have a large evangelical population? Abortion's a major issue. But what gets overlooked, and this is, and they actually go together, is that you've had a sort of gauntlet laid down by the Trump administration about belonging, about this is what you do to be one of us, you know, build the wall. This is what you do to, you know, call yourself an American. And when Latinos are constantly being subjected to apprehension and criticism and questioning about their, you know, citizen bona fides, it is not surprising to me that you will find some people who are essentially fed up with having their citizenship questioned and will just say, yes, I, you know, this is how I'm going to prove I'm an American. He has laid out a test and I will meet that test.
You've spoken with members of several different Latino voting rights groups, and I'd love if you could explain how their activism is inspired by this history that you're talking about.
It is, I think the other, you know, in addition to the kind of curiosity about, right, the Trump supporters, there's also the constant, well, what do we do about the Latinos? They're so different, right? You have Puerto Ricans in New York, you have Puerto Ricans in Florida and Colombians and Venezuelans. And as if, like, people cannot wrap their minds around this diversity. And what's interesting is you see that richness reflected in the organizing. So, for example, I talk with people in Arizona, and they really reach into that history of the Chicano movement, that organizing of in the Southwest in response to the civil rights movement in the 1960s and 70s, to learn from that, to learn how that sort of was abandoned, how they were abandoned by the Democratic Party, and to learn from that to organize people and chart a new path. Meanwhile, I'm talking with an organizer in North Carolina who is the daughter of farm workers. And when I ask her, well, are you inspired by, you know, Cesar Chavez's 1960s farm worker movement in California? She says, no, actually, I was the only Mexican-American kid in my school. I grew up going to an all-Black high school. And I learned a lot and influenced by the civil rights movement of North Carolina. She has the motto of North Carolina tattooed to her wrist. But she's also influenced by the social movements in Mexico, the search of the desaparecidos. So you really see people
pulling.
Almost like they're trying to patch together because our, I mean, we did a segment here on the show recently, Michelle, about the Underground Railroad that helped black slaves escape the United States, not to the north, but to Mexico. And the lack of a real United States educational system framework where for our history and our role in this country's civil rights movement has really forced us today to kind of patch together a reality based on these bits and pieces and scholarship like what you've done here. But it's really unfortunate that this history has taken so long to come to light.
It's true. I think, you know, what you, I interviewed Frances Negron there at Columbia University, and she said...
She's a friend of the show, by the way.
And she said, you know, what Latinos have contributed to the political culture of this country is imagination. So I would say that in the same way that the young lords, the Puerto Rican young lords in New York, 20% of that group was African American, you've had Latinos building and working in coalition for decades. You see this in North Carolina. The Grupo Red saying outright, we are a pro-Black, pro-Latinx LGBTQ group, right? Or in Arizona, you see that imagination in action. And I think it's also worth mentioning that the moral issue, the moral imperative that has gone unstudied is playing out right now. I mean, I interviewed Maria Teresa Kumar from Voto Latino, and she said, this moral, this is happening right now in the confluence of events of ongoing voter suppression, Latinos hit by COVID at just staggering rates, and the potential to have a major impact in these, particularly in these states of North Carolina, Arizona, and Texas. So you see this coalescing that is, we're in the center of a historic moment. And this history that we've been discussing provides the frame and the context for understanding that struggle and the meaning of all of these people turning out to vote.
Michelle Garcia is a journalist and essayist currently working on a nonfiction book about the border. Thanks so much, Michelle.
Thank you.
And that's all for us today. And don't forget, today is your last chance to cast a ballot and make sure your voice is heard this election. And we hope you stay safe out there. And of course, keep calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway. And we'll see you tomorrow on the other side.